Hello, and welcome to another episode of Waves of Change, a Great Lakes Now digital series focused on highlighting the diverse voices and perspectives shaping the environmental justice movement all throughout the Great Lakes region. I'm Anna Seisling, and I'm grateful to you for tuning in.
This program was brought to you by the Fred and Barbara Earp Family Foundation, the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, Richard C. Devereaux Foundation for Energy and Environmental Programs at Detroit PBS, Polk Family Fund, DTE Foundation, and contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Joining me today is Sharon Day. Sharon is enrolled in the Boys Fort Band of Ojibwe and makes her home in Minnesota, where she is a founder and executive director of the Indigenous Peoples Task Force, a vital provider of culturally appropriate health services, programs, and housing. She is a grandmother, great-grandmother, and an artist, musician, and writer. Sharon, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, miigwech. Thank you for having me.
Waves of Change is really rooted in environmental justice, and I know that's such a big and really loaded term, especially these days. So I wonder, when you hear environmental justice, what does that phrase mean to you in this moment?
When I think about environmental justice, I think about the Sierra Club, 360.org, the kinds of advocacy that those organizations do.
So on that note, I know that you are deeply connected to the place that you call home. So I want to ask you a little bit about your background and where you grew up and if nature and a connection to the natural world has always been a part of your life.
Yes, I grew up in northern Minnesota near the Boys Fort Reservation. All of my grandmothers and parents come from there. And we lived close to there. I was born at a little place called Sugar Bush. And then we moved a little bit away, not far, 30 miles maybe, and grew up on a place called Sand Lake and another place called Angora. And we didn't think about nature. We think about, the lake, fishing every day in the summer, picking strawberries, raspberries, blueberries. And in the fall, of course, harvesting wild rice. That's how I grew up.
I want to talk with you a little bit about the way that I initially learned about who you are. And that was through these water walks that you have led and been a part of in so many different places. Are these water walks related to environmental justice in some way?
The water walks are really a time where we speak to the water. And we believe that the water is a living entity and that it can hear us. Josephine Mendam and Yvonne, the grandmother who started the water walks back in 2003, said that the water listens, the water has a memory, and the water can hear. And she gave an example of going to some waterway where the water was still and stagnant. And she said she spoke to the water, made her offering, and sang a water song, and the water began to move. Began to come alive. And so she said, the water has to move in order to be healthy. And so she was going to carry the water around Lake Superior. And she did that in 2003. And I had the opportunity to walk with her at the beginning and then around the eastern shore near Wawa in Canada for a couple of days then. And then again in 2011. And then I've continued just about every year since then on some walk along some river or a lake. And why we do that is to help people get connected to the water. It's not about data or metrics or any of those things. It's making a connection to that water the way you do when you have a relationship with a close friend. And you would do anything for that friend. That's what we try to get people to feel about the water. Mm-hmm. We tell the water, we love you, we thank you, we respect you. And so that's what we do. And that is the only way I believe that we're going to save our waterways is for human beings to reconnect with the water in that way. But no amount of data or is Western science is going to do that. Even in Minnesota, where, you know, there are 10,000 lakes, people have a relationship to that lake that they grew up fishing on, or the lake they harvest wild rice on, or the lake that they go water skiing on. They have a connection to that body of water. But do most Minnesotans know that 45% of our waterways are impaired, or that most of the lakes in Minnesota you cannot swim in? No, they don't know. But you only protect that which you love. And so we need to make that connection with people and waters.
To your point around an average person in Minnesota maybe not knowing about some of the issues, some of the impairment that you just mentioned, I guess that kind of gets me into wanting to ask you a little bit about this aspect of the water walks being something that I know is culturally and traditionally sacred and also open for all people from all ethnic backgrounds and gender identities. Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about what comes out of having all these different people coming and participating in this.
Well, yesterday I walked with and the Children's Museum asked me to do something with some middle school age children. And she wanted me just to do a water ceremony with them. And I said, well, how about if we meet at Como Lake and we walk around the lake? And so we had a little bit of a conversation before we began. And it's probably 11 or 12 year old young student raised her hand. And she said to me, what does Two-Spirit mean? And so I said to her, it's like if you take LGBTQ, and then another student said A plus. And I said, yes, if you take any of those letters of the alphabet in Ojibwe, that person would be Two-Spirit. And she said, I'm Two-Spirit. And I said, well, great, because I am too. And, you know, we had that little moment there. So, you know, inviting, you know, most of the students were not people of color. There was a couple, but otherwise they were just, you know, your average grade school in Minnesota. And they walked. I told them they had to be silent on the walk. And so as they walked around the lake, as we approached other people and people would be just strolling along the lake talking, the kids would say to them, shh. You know, be quiet, listen to the, you know, and the birds and the wind. And so we proceeded around the lake and it was so, you know, at first they were scared to carry the water because they were worried about spilling. But then as soon as the first one took it, then the next one and the next one. And it was a really great opportunity to spend, you know, a couple hours with these middle school age kids and to notice how, you know, they were so quiet and they walked so reverently around that lake. So, you know, people can engage in an activity, you know, can create a community quite quickly.
You mentioned earlier Josephine, and I know that she was a really important figure to you early on and to so many people. I wonder if you can speak a little bit more in terms of your lineage in arriving to this work, and if there are any specific formative teachers or mentors that you've had, both human and more than human.
Yeah. So, you know, of course, my parents and my I only knew one of my grandmothers, grandmother, Effie Day, but we just called her Gram. She was one of the kindest, gentlest people I ever met. And she was born probably the late 1800s. And so you can imagine what she lived through. You know, my grandfather was killed. My dad and two of his brothers were all killed. And But my grandmother had every right to be a bitter human being, right? But she wasn't. She was, I never heard her say an unkind word. My grandmother was the epitome of grace. You know, little brown skinned woman who was just so kind. So she had, you know, I aspired to be like my, grandmother. And I think there were, I always seemed to be hanging around the old people. I would sit and listen to their stories. And, you know, my friends, when their parents would come home, they would, you know, start talking and they would all scurry away, but not me. You know, like I would just, I loved hearing those stories. And I wish I could remember more of them. And my own mother died of congestive heart failure when she was, well, I'm older than my mother was. She was 72 when she died. And but she also was very soft spoken, and she didn't talk much. But when she did talk, people listened. And she was very strong. She was like the rock in our family. My dad, on the other hand, was very charismatic. He was, you know, my mother was a saint, and you know, my dad was a practicing alcoholic, and he practiced a lot, so he got really good at it, I guess. And but he was also a musician, and I watched him make a canoe when I was a young person. He could make anything. He was really probably the smartest person I've ever met. But he just couldn't live in this world the way that it is. And I think the happiest he was when he was in the woods, hunting, fishing, trapping. He was a guide to Governor Partridge and Judge Miles Lord. You know, he would take them out. But he would also talk to them about politics. And I remember being like 10 years old, and we had debates about, you know, who should be president, John F. Kennedy or Richard Nixon. My dad chose Nixon, and, you know, I was just appalled. How could you do that? And he said, well, look back at history. The Republicans always treated the tribes as sovereign entities. And he would say, and the Democrats, all they want to do is give us a little handout once in a while. So so those were the people who, you know, were the most important in my life as a child growing up.
I want to ask you a little bit now to sort of segue with me. You know, when we were talking before recording this conversation, you told me that the water walks are both spiritual and political. I know that you work for the Indigenous People's Task Force. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that organization and about how you think about making space for both of these energies, both of these things in your own life in terms of politics and a spiritual practice.
Well, yeah, I don't see like a difference in our, you know, one of the things that my dad did teach us was like, you know, these grandmother, grandfather teachings about, you know, our values, love, kindness, to be generous, to be honest, to be respectful, and to seek wisdom, and to be humble. You know, those are the values that make us Ojibwe. And none of us are perfect in the practice of those values, but it's something that we should strive for. And so I don't see any really difference in my political work, because the values are the same, right? Whether I'm working within the Indigenous People's Task Force, or whether I'm at my farm tapping the maple trees, you know, I just have new baby chicks. And so, you know, every morning I'm out there, you know, to feed the chicks and to see how they're faring, and to feed the goats. And that's all based on like a reciprocal relationship I have with the animals and the plants, the trees on the farm, right? And this little patch of land that I'm responsible for. And it's just practicing those values. You know, the HIV work, you know, is because my brother and a woman I had helped do an intervention with, you know, in the 80s came to me and said, you know, I have AIDS. What are you going to do about it? And, you know, they came to me because I was working for the state. I was in a position to do something. And so you do what you have to do in terms of what your family needs, what the community needs. I'm Wabashashi Clan, Pine Marten, and I grew up with this in my head. Your responsibility as Wabashashi is to take care of the family, the clan, the band, the tribe, and ultimately all of humanity. That's what your job is in this life.
So in my sort of introduction that I gave a while back, I said that the Indigenous Peoples Task Force is a vital provider of culturally appropriate health services, programs, and housing. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the work that you're doing, about these health services, programs, and housing, what that looks like day to day, and how that relates to your larger commitment to, like you said, your family, humanity, and also the natural world.
So, for instance, we have a harm reduction program. You know, we start off with HIV services. The housing is all... the housing units are 8-sided, cedar siding, radiant floor heat, windows all the way around, and with the inner courtyard. You know, we wanted these buildings to be a place where people would feel happy. We asked them, what do you want? And that's how we built them. So it was, you know, to go from HIV services, you know, outreach, counseling and testing, case management, housing, to go from that to, you know, when the opioid epidemic hit us and hit us hard, we started doing harm reduction services, which includes providing people with supplies, syringe exchange, mat service, navigation services, that, all of that. But we decided that what people need is that connection again to spirit. And so every Wednesday during our syringe exchange hours, we build a fire outside, you know, a sacred fire. We put an altar there with tobacco, sage, and cedar. And when we first started putting it out, people didn't feel like they were worthy to pick up those medicines. But we had an elder sitting out there, and sometimes they would ask her, you know, would you go put some tobacco in the fire and pray for me? And she would do that. And then finally she started telling them, you can do this yourself. You can do this yourself. Your prayers for you know, the land, the animals, the plants, those are every bit as worthy as mine. And so now you see them come up to that fire, pick up that tobacco, put it in the fire, and then put a little cedar on the fire to cleanse it afterwards. So that's how our services are different. In our youth prevention services, we have tobacco prevention, ATOD prevention, suicide prevention components, but our delivery of those services, we begin every day with the tobacco circle. And so when the youth come in, many times they don't know where they're from, they don't have a spiritual name. But when they hear other youth who've been there longer announce themselves in the language, using the protocols, they go home and they find out, you know, where am I from? And a couple months go by and they're there saying Leech Lake and Dunjaba. You know, I'm from Leech Lake, and whatever else they've been able to find out. And they sing, they use sage to clear the space. They hand everybody tobacco. They sing the tobacco song when they're done. But when these young people, 11 to 18 years old, come and they sit in that circle, you know, we don't have to do these things like assessments and, you know, because it all happens in the circle. So you know more about what's happening in that kid's home, in school, and just by listening to them as they go around the circle. And so this is what keeps them strong. Also, the act of creating theater, to use their voice, to use their body, to tell the stories that are so important to our people, the songs that have been with us for 500 years, we are using the stories of our people, the stories that come out of my imagination, you know, and the kids add to that. They give us the right language of the day, right? That I don't know. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, so it becomes alive to them.
I can't help but think about people in Detroit or in Minneapolis, in these more urban environments, who might think like, well, I don't have access to a farm, or like, I don't remember the last time that I went and hung out by a body of water. Do you have any advice or anything that you'd like to say to those people in terms of like trying to make that first step, or how to go about beginning to maybe kindle some sense of connection?
All you have to do is like meet yourself, right? And you know, the little water walk we did yesterday was in the center of St. Paul, you know, this little mm-hmm. tiny man-made lake. You know, they have water coming into it all the time. And but it's a beautiful park, you know, and it's about a mile and a half around. And just to take these kids there, right in the middle of the city. Saturday, we did a walk at Battle Creek, and about 2.5 miles again, east side of St. Paul. We met, and then we walked down just where it goes into the Mississippi. So you just have to, and you know, find a spot anywhere and sit and be quiet and listen. And but nature's all around us.
You know, I wanted to ask you a little bit about what keeps you motivated and hopeful, whether that's been achieving any important policy changes or any wins. If there are things that you sort of look back on over the last year or 5 years that you're like, yeah, we did that.
Our youth have been involved in, we teach them, you know, about different forms of art and singing and, you know, all of the art forms. But in terms of policy, you know, our Wabanage and Bejigo Asema programs, you know, these young people go to the Capitol every year and they meet with their state representatives and senators, also with city councils. They've met with St. Paul, Minneapolis, Edina. They've also met with elected representatives of tribal government. And they did a short play with them. When they finished it, they turned and they looked at the elected officials, the tribal leaders, and they said, "And what will you do?" So they're involved in policy at a young age. You know, right now, this year, we're trying to increase the capacity of our people to have access to organic tobacco. Four programs came together and we showed them how to plant the tobacco seeds. And because they're very fragile, when they first pop up, germinate, they're like a little fine hair, little green hair sticking out of the soil. You have to really take care of them until they're ready to go into the ground. So right now we have like over 2,500. And you know, you learn so much. I've been growing tobacco since 2000, but we learn so much from taking care of plants, and everybody should grow something, even if it's a herb.
Sharon, I wonder who else is doing good work that you might want to shout out or uplift in your community.
No, there's so many wonderful organizations in Minneapolis and St. Paul that are doing great work. And, you know, Anda Young works with young people, provides shelter. Division of Indian Work. They have food programs and all kinds of doula programs, all kinds of programs. There's so many organizations doing great work across our parking lot. Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center provides a day drop-in center for women, and they're renovating their housing on the second and third floor.
And do you have any public gatherings or water walks that you have planned for later this year? Anything that you want to tell folks about?
Yes, we have. There's a river in Minnesota. The English word for it is Rum River. And it comes out of Lake Mille Lacs. And then it's about 151 miles. And then it ends into, enters the Mississippi River near Anoka, Minnesota. So we'll do that starting August 1st. But then next year, We're going to go to the Gulf of Mexico near New Orleans. It's about 90 miles south of there, Fort Jackson. And we'll gather some of the water there that's, you know, in the dead zone. And we're going to do an experiment where we're going to test that water there and document the condition it's in. And then we will carry it to the headwaters. And we're going to sing and we're going to pray for that water every day. And when we get to Lake Itasca, we'll test it again to see if, like Josephine said, it can come back alive. So that will be, I think, a year from September. It'll also be the year that I will, when we arrive in Minnesota, I will have turned 75. It'll be on our website, and we encourage people to join us someplace along the way for a day or 2 days or an hour or several. But yeah.
What is the website that people should go to find out?
It's nibiwalk.org. N-I-B like boy, I at walk.org.
Got it. Okay. All right. Well, Sharon Day, it's been such a joy and really such an honor to be in conversation with you. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me. And as we close out, I wondered if there was any last words that you want to leave our listeners with.
I always like to remind people that, you know, when we come into the world, at inception, we're about 98% water. When we come into the world, we come into the world in a gush of water, and we're about 85%. And at my age, I'm still over 50%. And so, you know, when we fall below 50%, you know, then we're ready to make that journey. So drink water.
All right, Sharon, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Waves of Change is a production of Great Lakes Now and Detroit PBS. This digital series is produced and edited by me, Anna Seisling, with additional support from Jordan Wingrove. Great Lakes Now's executive producer is Rob Green, and Detroit PBS Vice President of Content is Ed Moore.
This program was brought to you by the Fred and Barbara Earp Family Foundation, the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, Richard C. Devereaux Foundation for Energy and Environmental Programs at Detroit PBS, Polk Family Fund, DTE Foundation, and contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.